This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'din, wallahu samiyun alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم. فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم. فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, "My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing." And when she bore her, she said, "My Lord, I have borne a female child," and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, "O Mary, from where does this come for you?" She said, "It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia says it has destroyed several Ukrainian drones and speedboats near Crimea, as Kiev reports fresh Russian airstrikes on the capital city. Israeli forces kill yet another Palestinian teenager during a raid on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. And search and rescue operations are underway in Morocco, where the deadliest earthquake in decades has already claimed over 2,000 lives. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Russia says its forces destroyed 8 Ukrainian drones and 3 speedboats in the Black Sea area near Crimea. Russia's defense ministry said in a statement that the speedboats were carrying Ukrainian forces and were intercepted northeast of the Snake Island. It did not give details on casualties or damage from the incidents. Separately, Ukrainian officials say the Russian military launched airstrikes across the capital, Kiev. The city's military administration says drone debris fell on several neighborhoods. Kiev's mayor also confirmed at least one injury from the attacks. Moscow has been launching near-daily airstrikes on Ukrainian territory in recent weeks, as Ukraine has stepped up its own drone attacks on Russian targets and cities, with both sides claiming to repel most of the assaults. Correspondent to Moscow, Johnny Miller, earlier gave us a deeper look into what Ukrainian attacks on Russian forces near Crimea could entail.
Well, yes, it seems that Ukraine is continuing to attack Crimea. This is part of a broader aim of NATO to try to destabilize Russia. Indeed, this entire war is largely an attempt to try to destabilize Russia. So it's not the first time. It looks like perhaps that Ukraine has tried to land troops in Crimea. They've done that before with not much success. It's difficult to see what kind of strategy they are pursuing here. Ukraine is a very militarized area, a large area. It's difficult to see what the exact aims are, but Russia has such great defensive capabilities there. They're able to dispel most attacks, but almost on a daily basis, Ukraine attacks in some form or another Crimea, either with drones or increasingly trying to land men on the island. But Russia usually is able to dispel these attacks. So we're certainly moving into a new stage, and we expect that these attacks in Crimea and mainland Russia, if you like, by Ukraine, will only continue. But it's also important that particularly the Anglo-Americans, British and the Americans, have an obsession with Crimea, and the fear is that they're trying to edge, if you like, nuclear war, and by continuing to try and attack Crimea. There's been some strong words from Medvedev, former Russian Prime Minister, about these attacks and the potential of the greater escalation it could lead to.
Ukraine has criticized the G20's joint declaration for not condemning Russia for the Moscow-Kiev conflict, saying that it was nothing to be proud of. The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry said Kiev's participation in the G20 meeting would have allowed the members to better understand the situation. The ministry, however, thanked Ukraine's allies for doing their part to advance Ukraine's position in the declaration. The reaction came after G20 leaders refrained from directly criticizing Russia over the war in Ukraine. On climate also, the G20 found minimal common ground. There was no commitment to phase out the polluting fuels. Instead, countries pledged to triple renewable energy sources by 2030. The Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russia's Vladimir Putin skipped the annual gathering. Israeli forces have killed yet another Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian teen, identified as 16-year-old Milad Manther Al-Rai, was shot dead in Al-Arub refugee camp north of Al-Khalil. Local Palestinian media said that he was shot in the back in a raid by Israeli forces. Several other Palestinians were also injured. Israel has stepped up its crackdown on Palestinians following the formation of a far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. At least 230 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces since the start of the year. Tens of thousands of Israelis are back on the streets for the 36th consecutive week, protests against controversial judicial curbs by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet.
This is the 36th week in a row that we're demonstrating against Netanyahu's attempt to make a coup in Israel and make it a dictatorship. This demonstration is 3 days before the deliberations in the Supreme Court to disable the law that they passed right now.
Mass protests against the judicial overhaul, described by protesters as a judicial coup, have been ongoing since it was proposed back in January. Israel's Supreme Court began hearing the first in a series of appeals linked to the plan in August. It set off an unprecedented domestic crisis, resulting in public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of the military. Critics say the move removes vital checks on the far-right cabinet's powers. They say that they will continue with the protest until they are able to repeal the legislation. The Supreme Court will hear an appeal against the case on September 12th. Israeli soldiers have reportedly rioted during a training session for the regime's infantry forces, a sign of rising discontent in the Israeli military. A leaked video shows dozens of soldiers from the Golani Brigade vandalizing property and letting out angry shouts. According to the reports, the riots happened on September 4, 2023.
A recent video circulating on social media shows Israeli soldiers of the Army's Golani Brigade rioting during a training session in protest against the far-right Israeli cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent controversial policies. The video was reportedly filmed on September 4th. The leaked video shows dozens of soldiers from Israel's Golani Brigade shouting and vandalizing property. According to the reports, several of the protest participants had been disciplined by superiors, resulting in the arrest of several soldiers, including sergeants. The regime's Golani Brigade is mostly made up of elite soldiers specialized in ground warfare. They have carried out armed attacks against Palestinians and have participated in almost all the wars waged by the regime. Ever since the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the proposal for the judicial overhaul, which limits the authority of the national judiciary, the public has held mass demonstrations across Israel. Tens of thousands of military personnel from different sectors of the Israeli army have protested against the decision, including 10,000 reservists from intelligence units and Air Force pilots. They have threatened to no longer show up for duty in protest of Netanyahu's judicial reform efforts. Last month, Israel's Air Force chief suspended a number of senior military reserve forces in the wake of ongoing demonstrations against Netanyahu's judicial overhaul plan. The development came a day after the Israeli Navy suspended two high-ranking reservists after they announced plans to end volunteer reserve duties, in addition to refusing to serve in what they called a dictatorship. Also, cases of suicide within the Israeli occupation forces have grabbed headlines recently, with observers blaming a mental health epidemic among soldiers.
The soaring level of discontent with the far-right cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu's policies has placed Israel in a dangerous situation. Israeli officials have warned that the regime will be facing an existential threat if the current trend continues. However, is it going to end, or is it just the beginning of Israel's collapse from within?
In July, Israel's chief of staff, General Herzi Halevi, warned that the army's unity has dangerously deteriorated due to the thousands of reservists who have threatened to hold service in protest against the judicial overhaul Israel faces. He also warned that Israel would be in existential peril. Some other Israeli military officials have warned that the reservists' protests are impacting military readiness amid heightened tension between Israel and the axis of resistance, including Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hamas in recent months. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his supporters have rejected the reservists' protests as a dangerous and unprecedented form of political blackmail by the military, with some equating the protests to attempts at a military coup. Despite the threat of reservists refusing service, Netanyahu's far-right cabinet pushed ahead with the judicial overhaul legislation. The Knesset passed the legislation in a vote in July, despite months of large protests. The legislation struck down the ability of Israel's Supreme Court to veto legislation passed by the Knesset based on the criteria of reasonableness, despite calls from the protest movement to protect what they describe as Israeli democracy. The protesters have not called for the Netanyahu's cabinet to seize.
A group of anti-Iran elements have attacked the country's embassy in the French capital, Paris. A spokesperson for the Iranian embassy said the anti-Iran elements burnt tires in front of the embassy building and inflicted minor damage to the structure. The spokesperson added that the fire was put out shortly after the presence of police and the fire brigades. The official says the situation is now under control and that France's foreign ministry has been notified of the incident. The official noted that an investigation is underway into the attack to find out those behind the incident. Niger's junta says France is planning a military intervention in the country in collaboration with the regional bloc known as the Economic Community of West African States. Niger's rulers say that France is deploying forces and military equipment in several ECOWAS countries as part of preparations for the aggression. The former colonial power, France, refuses to recognize the military government in Niger, which took power after ousting President Mohamed Bazoum in July. France currently has about 1,500 soldiers stationed in the country. Niger's leaders have renounced several military cooperation agreements with Paris and say that French forces are now illegally stationed in Niger. Thousands of people have also held several gatherings around a military base housing French soldiers in the capital Niamey to demand their departure. Search and rescue operations are underway in Morocco to find survivors of a deadly earthquake that has claimed over 2,000 lives. Morocco's Interior Ministry says efforts are in full swing as the army, security services, and civil protection are mobilized to provide immediate relief. Local officials say that most of the deaths are in mountain areas that are hard to reach. The magnitude 7.2 quake struck in Morocco's high Atlas Mountains on Friday. Buildings have collapsed, historic sites damaged, and countless residents rushed from their homes in the country's deadliest tremor since at least the year 2004. The U.S. is now sending depleted uranium tank shells to Ukraine, even though they were widely blamed for increasing cancer and birth defects in Iraq. It is the latest escalation which Washington is resorting to as the Russian military continues to prevail against the Ukrainian counteroffensive. Ramin Mazari has more from Chicago.
The United States announced they are sending depleted uranium shells for tanks to Ukraine, even though they pose the risk of serious civilian health issues for generations. The use of such toxic shells by the United States in Fallujah, Iraq, is often blamed there for an increase in cancer, birth defects, and infant mortality. Depleted uranium shells now follow F-16 fighter jets, cluster munitions, tanks, and other escalatory measures which Washington had said they would refrain from using in the conflict.
Piles that much more of an atrocity on the atrocities that we're already committing, the atrocity of overthrowing the democratically elected leadership of Ukraine and forcing it into a 9-year race war, is a horror that should have taught Americans long before this that their government does not care about Ukraine, does not care about Russia, and it's a hard pitch to say that they care about America either.
The toxic shells were announced during a surprise visit to Kiev by the United States Secretary of State, where he announced another $1 billion in funding.
The new security funding that we're announcing today will also be bolstered by the arrival of U.S. Abrams tanks this fall and by training for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in the United States, complementing training that is already underway in Europe. In the ongoing counteroffensive, progress has accelerated in the past few weeks. This new assistance will help sustain it and build further momentum.
So far, the U.S. has given some $80 billion to Ukraine, or an average of nearly $1 billion per week since the unrest increased in February 2022. All the Western military aid has so far failed to succeed. The Ukrainian counteroffensive has barely dented Russian defenses. Western tanks often smolder on the battlefield. U.S. leaders now admit the war will continue for years. The obvious Russian success has many questioning the alleged military supremacy of the United States and NATO.
I think that there's no way that the West can win this war, and we're not fighting it to win it. We're fighting it to wear Russia down, using Ukraine as our blunt instrument to wear Russia down, smashing our friends, our allies, into the brick wall in hopes of knocking a few bricks out. But the narrative that has been sold to, is being relentlessly sold to Americans, is that we're on the verge of winning.
Congress is currently negotiating a bill for another $20 billion in weapons, even as polls show 55% of Americans don't want more funding for Ukraine. The influx of money has led to such rampant allegations of bribery that it just forced the replacement of Ukraine's Minister of Defense. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea Saturday marked the 75th anniversary of its founding with a large military parade in the capital, Pyongyang. This comes as the country's face-off with a southern neighbor and the U.S. is further deepening. Frank Smith has more from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea Friday celebrated the 75th anniversary of its founding, with leader Kim Jong-un and his daughter observing a large military parade and fireworks in Pyongyang's Kim Il-sung Square. On this occasion, the parade did not include missiles or large weapons. However, analysts suggest such events, which have taken place frequently in recent years, send a message. Delegations from the DPRK's traditional allies, China and Russia, traveled to Pyongyang for the occasion, demonstrating stronger ties amid a shift toward more difficult relations with South Korea. The past year and a half have been particularly tense on the Korean Peninsula. Coming to office in May of 2022, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol resumed large-scale joint military exercises with the United States, and North Korea conducted more missile tests than ever before. The celebrations in Pyongyang come following reports Russia may purchase artillery shells and other weapons from the DPRK. The U.S. earlier this week issued a stern warning. Despite that warning from the U.S., multiple reports indicate DPRK leader Kim Jong-un will travel next week to Russia to again meet for talks with President Vladimir Putin. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight. In the United States, a judge on Friday has denied former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' bid to move the Georgia criminal case against him to a federal court of law. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A judge on Friday, 8th of September, denied Mark Meadows' request to move his Georgia election subversion case to a federal court of law, ruling that the Trump White House chief of staff must fight the charges in a state court instead. U.S. District Judge Steve Jones in Atlanta, Georgia, wrote in a 49-page ruling that Mark Meadows has not met even the quite low threshold to move his case to a federal court of law, noting that the question was whether the actions at issue were related to his role as a federal official. The evidence adduced at the hearing establishes that the actions at the heart of the state's charges against Mark Meadows were taken on behalf of the Trump campaign, with an ultimate goal of affecting state election activities and procedures, Judge Jones wrote. Meadows himself testified that working for the Trump campaign would be outside the scope of a White House chief of staff. The ruling is a big early win for Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis, who spent 2.5 years investigating and building a case against the former President Donald Trump. The case is also against Mark Meadows and 17 other defendants. Donald Trump has indicated that he's considering asking for his trial to be moved to a federal court of law, and several other defendants have already made the request. The ruling by Judge Jones against Mark Meadows could signal that the others may struggle to meet the burden required to win removal when their lawyers make their arguments before the judge later on this month. Though Judge Jones made clear that he will assess each of those cases individually. The practical efforts of moving to a federal court would be a jury pool that includes a broader area than just overwhelmingly Democratic Fulton County, and a trial that would be not photographed or televised, as cameras are not allowed inside federal courtrooms. But it would not open the door for Donald Trump if he is re-elected in 2024, or another president to issue pardons, because any conviction would still happen under state law. A lawyer for Mark Meadows did not immediately request for comment. On Friday evening, Mark Meadows' attorneys filed a notice that he plans to appeal the court ruling. In a court filing earlier this week, he asked to separate his case from the other defendants in the case and to halt his proceedings in the state court until a final determination is reached on his attempt to move to a federal court of law, including through appeal if an appeal is taken. Mark Meadows and the others were indicted last month by a Fulton County grand jury on charges they participated in a spoiling scheme to illegally try to overturn Donald Trump's 2020 presidential election loss in Georgia, even though the state's voters had selected Joe Biden. All of them have pleaded not guilty. Mark Meadows said his actions were taken as part of his role as chief of staff to the Republican president. He and his lawyers also argued that since he was a federal official at the time, the charges against him should be heard in a federal court of law. Prosecutors said the actions laid out in the indictment were meant to keep Donald Trump in office after he lost to Joe Biden, a Democrat. They said the acts were explicitly political in nature and are illegal under the Hatch Act, which restricts partisan political activity by federal employees. As such, they said, the case should stay in Fulton County's Superior Court. Judge Jones wrote that the evidence overwhelmingly suggests that most of the actions attributed to Mark Meadows in the indictment did not fall within his scope of executive branch duties. The cable broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. U.S. District Judge Steve Jones concluded that some of Mark Meadows' high-stakes testimony on the witness stand last month was lacking, and even those, some of the former Trump chief of staff's testimony was used against him. When questioned about the scope of his authority, Mark Meadows was unable to explain the limits of his authority, other than his inability to stump for president or work on behalf of the campaign, Judge Jones wrote, saying he would give Mark Meadows' testimony on that topic less weight than the other evidence. Judge Steve Jones also cited Meadows' acknowledgement that the lawyers he included in an infamous 2021 phone call with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger were working for Trump or his campaign and not the government. The distinction between government and political work is key because the effort to move Meadows' case to a federal court of law was motivated by seeking a type of immunity sometimes extended to people who are prosecuted for conduct tied to their U.S. government roles. In his 49-page ruling, District Court Judge Steve Jones also highlighted Meadows' testimony about a December 2020 meeting with state lawmakers from Michigan. Mark Meadows said most of the meeting had to do with allegations of potential election fraud, and Donald Trump had a personal interest in the election in Michigan. Accordingly, the meeting was outside the scope of his federal executive branch office, as they related to state election procedures following the presidential election, Judge Jones concluded. The judge said in a footnote that his findings should be interpreted as an opinion on Meadows' propensity to be truthful as a general matter. The national broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. A judge on Friday, 8th of September, denied former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' bid to move Georgia criminal case against him to a federal court of law, ruling that his alleged involvement in efforts to pressure state leaders to overturn the 2020 election results was not part of his official duties. U.S. District Judge Steve C. Jones issued the ruling after holding a hearing on the matter in Atlanta, Georgia federal court last week, that included 5 hours of testimony from Mark Meadows, who, along with former President Donald Trump, was charged last month in Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis's sweeping election interference case. The court concludes that Mark Meadows has not shown that the actions that triggered the state prosecution related to his federal office, Judge Jones wrote. Meadows' alleged association with post-election activities was not related to his role as a White House chief of staff, or even executive branch authority. State prosecutors, Judge Jones said, had put forth evidence that at various points during the time of the alleged conspiracy, Mark Meadows worked with the Trump campaign which he admitted was outside of his role as the White House Chief of Staff. In light of the state's evidence that Mark Meadows undertook actions on behalf of the campaign during the time period of the alleged conspiracy, Meadows was required to come forward with competent proof of his factual contention that his actions involved challenges to the outcome of the Georgia's presidential election results were within his role as the Chief of Staff. His efforts fall short of that, the judge wrote. Mark Meadows later notified the court that he would appeal the ruling. His attorney did not immediately respond for comment. To date, 5 of the 19 defendants in the district attorney's case have moved to have their case heard in a federal court of law. In a court filing this week, Donald Trump said he might move to do so as well. Under court-ordered deadlines, he has until the end of this month to decide. Judge Steve Jones said in Friday's ruling that his decision does not at this time have any effect on the outcome of the other co-defendants who have filed notices of removal. The indictment in Fulton County alleges that Donald Trump, Mark Meadows, and 17 other co-defendants engaged in schemes aiming to subvert the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in this program, we will discuss America's horrendous legacy in Afghanistan. So stay with us.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss a trail of US misdeeds in Afghanistan. And we shall also take a look at the motive behind launching the so-called war on terror.
The withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan 2 decades after its unwanted arrival in the country left behind a nation grappling with uncertainty and turmoil. As we mark 2 years since its shameful exit from Afghan soil, it is imperative to remember the long list of human rights violations during its military presence in the country. While the West claimed that the so-called war on terror brought stability in the country, the reality is otherwise. Civilian casualties, indiscriminate airstrikes, unlawful detentions, and other crimes against humanity form a part of the harrowing reality.
The Operation Enduring Freedom, led by the United States, was launched in 2001 under the pretext of dismantling the Taliban regime. However, the outcome has been marred by a grim legacy. Since 2001, an estimated 75,000 Afghan military and police personnel and more than 71,000 civilians have lost their lives. Reports reveal that NATO-led airstrikes resulted in the death of nearly 1,600 children just between 2016 and 2020. Unlawful detentions became another contentious issue, with tens of thousands held without charges or access to legal representation. According to reports, 70-90% of detainees were rounded up without proper evidence. Secret trials, based on questionable allegations, raised concern with no substantial action ever taken. According to human rights experts, the actions of the US government in Afghanistan were a failure, and the military occupation was not only the political hegemony of the United States, but also the hegemony of the West.
The US invasion of Afghanistan, falsely justified under the banner of counterterrorism, reveals a more complex narrative. While the pretext of America's longest war was to eradicate the Taliban and al-Qaeda, deeper motives that fueled the Afghan war are often overlooked. Buried lies a tale of strategic maneuvering, political interests, pursuit of the mineral wealth of Afghanistan, and the astonishing surge in opium production that unfolded in the aftermath of the US invasion.
Afghanistan's tumultuous history has been marked by decades of conflict, with the opium trade contributing to the violence in the region. Before the US invasion, the Taliban had banned opium production as it went against the laws of Islam. When the US-led invasion ousted the Taliban regime in the early 2000s, paradoxically, opium production surged, transforming Afghanistan into the world's largest producer, accounting for a startling 90% of global output. United Nations data shows a 35-fold increase in opium production since the US intervention, rising from 185 tons in 2001 to a staggering 6,400 tons in the recent years. While the official narrative claimed to fight terrorism, the US forces openly guarded poppy fields in the Afghan countryside and maintained connections with Afghan drug kingpins. According to some political observers, economic interests attracted America to Afghanistan and not the false rhetoric of cracking down on terrorist groups. Strategic relation experts say that the US invaded Afghanistan to loot its vast mineral wealth, including the huge lithium deposits, and to resurrect the poppy fields.
Now let's talk about the women of Afghanistan. By omitting the history of the crimes committed by the NATO military alliance in Afghanistan, the United States has been trying to show itself as a rescuer of Afghan women. However, figures show the real picture. As per statistical data, after 20 years of US presence in Afghanistan, various forms of violence against the Afghan women have increased. Experts say there has been an astronomical rise in cases of self-immolation, trafficking, prostitution and kidnapping in the past 2 decades.
During the 2-decade occupation of Afghanistan, United States used Afghan women as a symbol to legitimate their bombing campaign in the country and also justify their war on terror. Claiming that the so-called war on terror was also a fight to restore the rights and dignity of Afghan women, the Bush administration declared that the US was able to liberate the Afghan women and guarantee them a rightful place in the society. Rejecting West's claim of women empowerment, Afghan women rights activists have been saying that the world has maintained a total silence over the atrocities committed against women during the US presence in Afghanistan.
Well, Afghan women sadly have been the most affected segment of the Afghan society over the last 20 or 40 years. And the problem is that they have not been seen as sort of a very important segment of society, which nobody can win a war without the help or support of women in Afghanistan. And I think if you analytically look at the data as well, I'm not sure, but I think Afghan women widows would be one of the ratio of widow in Afghanistan would be one of the highest in the world, if not the topmost. So Afghan women have suffered not just because of the war, but of the economic situation on the ground as well. They have suffered poverty. They have suffered a lot of problems in the last 20 years. When the U.S. was waging a war in Afghanistan, the only aim it had was to achieve a military success in that area. And if it affected women or men or children, they didn't care about at that time. They did say on the surface that they are supporting them through NGOs and welfare funds. But I think that was very little amount that actually got to these women.
Experts say that the early expressions of support for Afghan women in the midst of U.S. military action served to paint a feminist glow on some of the most brutal bombings by America and its allies. Despite Western declaration of empowering the Afghan women, the female literacy rate in the country has not changed in the last 20 years. And the horrors the Afghan women suffered during the violent two-decade U.S. occupation of the country still remain enshrouded in mystery.
We hardly get to hear about Afghan refugees in Western media and the severity of the Afghan refugee crisis. The humanitarian catastrophe brought by the two decades of U.S. occupation made millions of Afghans homeless. The destruction inflicted on civilians by the so-called war on terror has been incalculable. The figures given by the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, shows that at the end of 2020, there were around 2.8 million Afghan refugees worldwide, the vast majority of them in Iran and Pakistan. However, the actual number of displacements are probably twice the number.
Statistics show that at least 37 million people have fled their homes during the wars the U.S. military has launched since 2001. However, experts believe the total displaced by the U.S. post-9/11 wars could be closer to 48 to 59 million, as the international statistics generally count only the registered refugees. According to a 2020 research paper written by a joint research team from the U.S. universities of Boston and Brown, in 2015, there were almost as many unregistered Afghan refugees in Pakistan, around 1.3 million, as there were registered refugees, which happens to be 1.5 million. Analysts say that this huge influx of refugees to the neighboring countries has led to socio-cultural, economic, and political effects in the host states, also putting pressure on their resources.
Well, it has been, of course, mishandled on a mammoth scale, for sure. Otherwise, we would not have been where we are today in Afghanistan. From day one, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, the U.S. policy and its allies' policy vis-a-vis Afghanistan has been one of the failures after another one. We have seen that in the last two decades, they managed to bring in a system, a democratic system in Afghanistan on artificial basis that could not survive once they decided to leave. It fell apart the next day when the Americans left Afghanistan. The policy, if we are to assess Afghanistan's situation, we shouldn't be assessing it on the basis of the last 20 years. It should be, I think it's been more than 40 years that the US CIA and its allies like Pakistan have been trying to maneuver situation in Afghanistan, and they have not been successful in achieving what they wanted to achieve, a democratic Afghanistan.
As per experts, during the 20 years of its presence in Afghanistan, the United States played an essential role in breaking the Afghan society, leaving the people in desperate condition. The displacement caused by the U.S. war in Afghanistan has torn apart families, neighborhoods, communities, alongside other forms of wartime violence.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by political analyst and journalist Mr. Tahir Khan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Now, sir, the U.S. military withdrew from Afghanistan after 20 years of occupation. What has been the implications of this hasty withdrawal on the stability of the country, and also why the so quick withdrawal of the U.S. military forces?
Thank you for inviting me. I would not say a hasty withdrawal because the U.S. and its NATO allies, they had already decided to leave Afghanistan because they were not successful. And they were the Taliban fighting against the foreign troops. They forced them to come to the negotiation table, because the U.S. and the NATO allies were expecting that they would weaken the Taliban. And after the Taliban are weakened, they would go for the negotiation. But that was that approach was not, I think, based on realities. So this was the already the American had in mind to leave Afghanistan. And you would know, the Taliban and Qatar and the U.S. A former ambassador to Pakistan and Afghanistan, Richard Olson, for the first time in 2015, they started interaction. But the formal negotiations started in 2018. And so the American had a plan to leave Afghanistan because they did not achieve what they wanted to, because they want to finish the Taliban. They want to punish the Taliban. This was their claim. But Taliban were more stronger, and the American could not achieve their objectives. That's why they withdrew. So I would not say it was a hasty decision, but because they were not successful to defeat the Taliban.
Okay, so talking about Taliban, with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, Afghanistan faced a rapid shift in power. What factors allowed the Taliban to regain control so swiftly?
Yes. I would say one factor was the division among the leaders in Afghanistan that time. Dr. Ashraf Ghani and Dr. Abdullah, they both took oath as president. So it never happened in anywhere. I don't think it happened anywhere in the world. So there was division within the political leadership. And I would say the Afghan National Army was tired, I would say. And they were under psychological stress when the Americans and the Taliban signed the agreement in 2020 on February 29. So that withdrawal agreement was a psychological pressure on the Afghan forces. The second factor was the people did not want more war, because Taliban were fighting in villages, in rural areas, in mountains, and sometime on the road just to explode a bomb. But the people, there was no fighting in the cities. So the cities were safe. And that's why the people in, when the Taliban started controlling the provinces, they started from the northern provinces. And Taliban had never been any influence in the north. But because of the people's frustration over the war, they forced their officials in different provinces to hand over the provinces to the Taliban. So Taliban started from the north. They took control of several provinces in the north. This encouraged the Taliban in the east, in the west, in the south to move forward, because the army did not want to fight to fight more. The people were not willing that the war should be shifted to the cities from the villages. This was the main factors: political division, the morale of the Afghan forces, and the people pressure on the leadership that they don't want more war. So this paved the way for the Taliban to take control of Afghanistan.
Mr. Tahir Khan, there was another thing I wanted to ask. Was the U.S., when they left, The reason I used their swift withdrawal was because they left a lot of their equipment behind, which is like worth millions of dollars. What is the reason behind that?
I was in Kabul in July, in the last week of July, and I went to the defense ministry in Kabul and I met some official there. I was told by one Taliban leader, defense official, Major General Abdul Latif Hakimi, who was previously the Taliban spokesman when there was a war in Afghanistan. He was telling me that the Americans destroyed many, many things, even the airfields and some infrastructure they have built. And even they tried to damage the tanks and everything. But they could not shift everything. They destroyed many things. So that's why the Taliban government now trying to repair some of the tanks, the helicopters, and other military vehicles. But the American could not take more weapons with them. So because they want to leave Afghanistan.
That's right, sir. Mr. Tariq Khan, the so-called war on terror in Afghanistan led to serious human rights violations by the NATO troops. Now, the perpetrators of the war crimes are still free. Why have the world organizations have been silent over this?
Now, this is a very good question. I would say the double standard of the Western countries, the double standard of the international, some organizations like International Court of Justice, War Criminal Courts. If people were killed in Afghanistan, there were strikes on the wedding ceremonies in Afghanistan, many civilians were killed. So in, they say this is not a human human violation. And the Guantanamo is Guantanamo was for everyone, because you may have heard from the prisoner who spent time in Guantanamo, because I met several the Guantanamo former prisoners. They faced a lot of problems there. So this is the double standard. I would say very briefly that the West, the Americans, the other Western European countries, they have a double standard. For them, human rights is issue is when it favors them. And from in other countries like Afghanistan, like Iraq, like Syria, when people are killed by the Americans or other countries, so for the Americans and the NATO and the European, this is not. So I would say this is double standard. And we still face this approach by the U.S. and the Western allies.
That's right, sir. Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Despite claims,
I
want to talk about the opium trade. Despite claims to curtail opium trade, the production of opium remained high during the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. So my question would be, how did the United States benefit from the drug trade?
This is very simple. If I don't stop the poppy production, poppy opium cultivation, and then they knew, because the Taliban, the American forces were everywhere. I myself visited Helmand, which was the main provinces for this opium production. And believe me, I have seen on the main roads huge fields of this opium production, the cultivation of the opium poppy. The problem is, they were. You are right. They were not. They could stop this cultivation of this opium and this drug, but they did not. So, because there was a war, and they were the control of those areas, but they did not stop them. So it means if you don't stop poppy cultivation or narcotic smuggling, it means you have benefit of all this. And this war, this American war in Afghanistan, the NATO war in Afghanistan. Every time you can, if you go to the media in the past, the Americans' factories of the weapons, some Western interests, they were involved in that war, because it was the war was run in Afghanistan by the American Western interests. So the opium production, I think they would be definitely benefiting them if they did not stop those poppy cultivation. And the problem is, Americans have left. Americans have gone. They were defeated. But they left the weapons problem for the neighboring countries, for Afghans, the opium issue. So now Iran, Pakistan, Central Asia, they are facing multiple problems because of the war in Afghanistan. And the Americans are now safe in Washington and New York, and we are facing the problem.
So if you could just shortly tell me, how has the government now contained the opium problem?
I think they had, I would say, I would not say 100% control, because, you know, the Taliban also, they knew that if there is no alternative to the opium. So although their leader, the Amir, has already banned this, and in many areas, in Helmand and other areas, which was traditionally the poppy cultivation areas, I have also heard from many people that now this is not very easy for the very traditional poppy, the people who are involved in the cultivation, in the business. So to some extent, I would say it has been controlled, but I would not say that fully the Taliban have controlled this, because Taliban also know that if you totally ban these things, so maybe the people would suffer, and the people who are depending on this. And the second thing is the international community, especially the West, who brought the war to Afghanistan, they are not very interested to help the common people. Because when I was in Helmand last year, the local people were telling me that they were forced to stop the cultivation, but they were complaining that they were not given the alternative. So the Americans, the European, and the NATO, they should help those people who were forced to stop this cultivation of the poppy.
They had 20 years to do this. Mr. Tahir Khan, thank you for being with us, sir.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. There you have it, political analyst and journalist Mr. Tahir Khan from Islamabad. Glad to have him on the program. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Izzat Ghafouri, a journalist, tweeted, "My pen is unable to write their pain. The crimes of America and England in Afghanistan are unforgivable. This young man was 10 years old when his father, mother, and three sisters and three little brothers were bombed and dismembered." Nar Edley, founder and director of Mint Press News, wrote, "In 2016, when the US military dropped bombs on Doctors Without Borders Trauma Hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, killing over 40 people and injuring hundreds more, the Pentagon investigated itself and concluded it didn't commit war crimes." Asif Durrani, Pakistan's special representative on Afghanistan, tweeted, "Being the champion of human rights, the US should voluntarily submit its record of human rights violations in Afghanistan and Iraq, where approximately 900,000 people got killed. At the same time, Guantanamo Bay concentration camp is still operative." Maliha Hashmi, a journalist, UN consultant and trainer, tweeted, "The US, UK and Australia and other countries must be held accountable for human rights violations by their military in Afghanistan." Chen Zhu, China's UN envoy, tells Human Rights Council. Alex Rubenstein, an independent journalist, posted, "Eagerly awaiting a Pandora Papers-style info dump explaining where the money from Afghanistan's opium trade is sitting. Afghanistan went from having 7,606 hectares used for poppy cultivation in 2001 to 328,000 hectares in 2017. According to US military, a 4,212% plus increase since invasion."
And that was our episode on 2 years since the humiliating US withdrawal from Afghanistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Republicans are seeking access to President Biden's vice presidential records during the Obama administration from the National Archives and Records Administration. We take a look at some of the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. America's national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story. Republican investigators are seeking unrestricted special access to President Biden's vice presidential records to obtain any information about potential contact during that period with Hunter Biden and other family members and their business partners. In a letter this week to the National Archives and Record Administration, House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer requested additional information regarding communications between the office of the vice president and Hunter Biden or his business associates. And Comer also said the committee needs to review these documents in their original format. James Comer highlights records that were recently posted to the National Archives website with sections redacted under the Presidential Records Act and the Freedom of Information Act. As one example, the Republican letter cites email traffic from December of 2015 between a longtime Biden family business associate and a senior White House communications official. On 4th of December 2015, in an email with the subject of, quotes, Eric Schwerin, a longtime Biden family business association, wrote to Kate Bedingfield in the office of the vice president, providing quotes the White House should use in response to media outreach regarding Hunter Biden's role in Burisma. Burisma is a Ukrainian energy company. Later on that day, on 4th of December 2015, Ms. Bedingfield responded to Mr. Schwerin saying, Vice President signed off on this. In response, White House spokesman Ian Sams posted on social media, as James Comer tells it, then Vice President Joe Biden colluded with his business Burisma by saying he doesn't endorse it and wasn't involved with it. Total nonsense. And he included a screenshot of what he said Mr. Biden had signed off on, highlighting a part that read, the Vice President does not endorse any particular company and has no involvement.